You know, we had to call California and call Dottie and say, God, Dottie, we can't have you. But we said, we'll have you at a later date. And graciously enough, she says, okay, and I'll be back. And she says, is that a promise? And we says, yeah. So we brought up Dottie, and, you know, it was really good to see Dottie again. And she forgot to wear one thing. She forgot her red hat tonight. And I was very disappointed when I first saw her. And without anything further ado, a delightful lady, Dottie S. from Hollywood, California.
I'm an alcoholic, and my name is Dottie Shore. Hi. Oh, I love Alcoholics Anonymous, don't you? Can you hear me back there? What am I supposed to do? Right like that, huh? I hit my teeth, then what am I going to do?
I warned you about it, Dottie.
Yeah. Now can you hear me back there? All right. I'm also a neurotic. Can I grab you someplace? A neurotic is a person who makes decisions that are destructive to themselves. How many neurotics have got in here tonight? About 10 years ago, I had the privilege of starting a meeting. I call it a step study meeting for emotionally induced illnesses. That's a long word. But it's for alcoholics and compulsive overeaters and narcotics addicts and migraine headaches and ulcers and high blood pressure and all the emotionally induced illnesses. And they wanted me to lead more than one meeting, and I couldn't. I was only going to do it for 12 weeks, you know, a meeting of a step a week. And compulsive that I am, it's going on 10 years now that I've been doing this thing. And so a group of the people wanted another meeting, and I said, well, I can't give it to you. You'll have to, you know, start your own. And so they started a group called Emotional Health Anonymous, and it's now nationwide. So I'm really pleased I had a little bit to do with that. And they're the ones that came up with the definition of a neurotic. It's a person who makes decisions that are destructive to themselves. Now, the difference between a psychotic and a neurotic, a psychotic says 2 and 2 are 5. A neurotic says 2 and 2 are 4, and I can't stand it. I like that. So that's why I think I'm a neurotic. You know, recently I've had a lot of fun. I go to a lot of meetings, and I'm privileged to speak out of town a lot, and I just love it. And I've been listening to people when they read. And not too long ago, a man got up to read the 12 steps, and he says, thoroughly have we seen a person fail who has rarely followed our path. I thought that was kind of good. Then not too long ago, I was speaking in Fullerton, and this leader asked somebody to read the 12 positions of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I thought that was kind of good, too. I do a lot of speaking at Overeaters Anonymous meetings, and someone the other night said, rarely have I seen a person get full who has thoroughly followed the path. So anyhow, if you know any of them, give them to me. I'm kind of collecting them. It's kind of fun. It's really simply a delight to be here. Your place is beautiful. I wish all the California people would come up here and leave our California alone so that they wouldn't ruin it like they have, and you could have them all up here. The last time the only time I was in Oregon is when I spoke at Grants Pass at the Rogues Roundup last year, and I almost went crazy there. I took pictures of lilacs and rhododendrons and all this until I almost went crazy. When I got home and had them develop, the lens in my camera had a crack in it, so they were totally, totally ruined. And one of the members from Grants Pass came down to North Hollywood and called me, and I went over and had coffee with him and talked to him and happened to mention the fact that this, you know, I was disappointed about this. And they had assigned me a driver, and this young man, good-looking dude, darn it, he went back and told this young man, and he remembered all the places I had asked him to stop to take pictures, and he went and took all the pictures again and sent them to me. This is great love that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous. Pete and Marty have been absolutely delightful to me today. I think I'll stay. There's no sense in going home when I get waited on the way I'm doing, you know. Go home and wait on myself, that's foolish. Although Marty said 2 days and I've had it, so I'm going to just wait here a couple of days. I'd like to share with you people some things that I learned about the disease of alcoholism. You know, we have a lot of fun when we're sober, thank God. And I look around this group tonight and I think of all the untold misery and tragedy that's in this room due to the disease called alcoholism. And when we get sober, you know, we have a good time, we have fellowship, and we laugh. But we've got to understand that we are dealing with a killer terminal illness called alcoholism. It's really not very funny. It's a delight and a pleasure and a refreshing thing when we get sober. But what is this strange disease we're talking about? Every time I hear an Al-Anon member talk, and I love Al-Anon with all my heart, they saved my life. And I'll tell you about that a little later. But I just wonder about these Al-Anon people. What's the difference between Bonnie's body and mine? And Marty's body and mine? I'm prettier than they are. I'm certainly not younger, but I look it. And, oh, I'm going to get it. At any rate, I suffer from analysis paralysis, you know, and I have to analyze and find out everything. And so several years ago, there was a paper put out by the Yale Institute on Alcoholism. They're the only medical group that I know that have done anything on the research of the disease. And they took 6 alcoholics and hospitalized them until by blood count and urinalysis there was no alcohol in their system. They asked for 6 non-alcoholic volunteers. They gave the 12 people a pint of whiskey to drink, and they waited 24 hours from the last drink. They began testing again. In every one of the non-alcoholics, they found it either totally out of the body or in the bladder, ready to be passed out in the urine. However, in every one of the alcoholics, they found it in the spinal fluid. Now, they say we have a biochemical imbalance. We have a gland that doesn't function. They call it an X factor. Someplace in here, I got something that doesn't work very well, and it's an X factor. They didn't even go on, so far as I know now, to find out what gland it was that failed, but they likened it to the pancreas failing in a diabetic. Now, once this happens in the alcoholic, whether it's by the excessive use of alcohol or never functions, and in my particular case, I don't believe it ever did function. I was alcoholic from the very first drink. Once this happens, we can't burn up, oxidize, and use alcohol in the proper way. It goes into the bloodstream, to the spinal fluid, and to the brain. The first part of the brain of the alcoholic that's affected is the frontal part up here that contains the eye care factor. That is deadened or put to sleep immediately. Now, if someone came in here tonight and shot me in the front of the head with a shot of Novocaine, and I proceeded to do the obscene or crazy things that most alcoholics do, no one would have me arrested or tell me I was a no-good woman. They would take care of me until the sedation had left my head. But because we alcoholics are ambulatory and look like there's nothing wrong with us, we're called no-good people. So many alcoholics think they're bad people who drink too much. No, dear hearts, we are alcoholics who do bad things when we drink. Now, once we have this gland that doesn't function, there's no turning back. There's no way they can activate it again. So once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. And we can't cure it any more than you can cure diabetes. But you can't arrest it. Now, if you're fortunate enough to get to Alcoholics Anonymous, you will learn about this. I worked in pharmacy for many, many years, and I used to stand at the counter and have people come up to my counter weeping and crying because they had been diagnosed as diabetics. And I would help them with their insulin and their diet and talk to them and kind of, you know, comfort them a little bit. But in a week or 10 days, they would come back in and they would be pretty well reconciled. They had started doing their whatever they had to do to rest this thing and would go about their business. Dear hearts, why can't we do that? Why can't you come in tonight if you're new and find out you have this strange, cunning, baffling, powerful disease that no way can you do anything about it, that once you take alcohol in any form, it will go into your bloodstream, to your spinal fluid, and to your brain and give you the personality change of the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Why isn't that enough? Because we have two parts of our disease. We have what the diabetic does not have, and that is this thing called the obsession of the mind. Now, the AA book puts it better than I can, and I'd like to quote it as kind of paraphrase it, I'll say. It says, the great obsession of every abnormal drinker is that somehow, some way, someday, we're going to control and enjoy this. The delusion is astonishing. Many will pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. That's the obsession. Somehow, some way, it's going to be different. Now, it tells me that no one likes to feel they are bodily or mentally different than their fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless, listen, countless vain attempts to prove we can drink like other people. So we have two parts of the disease. Now, if we're blessed, we get to Alcoholics Anonymous. See, many are called, but few are chosen. And when you come in here, and if you came in here tonight and you have 1 hour of sobriety, you have what I call a pearl of great price. I think you'll notice I wear a pearl on my neck. It was given to me many years ago. This is my pearl of great price, as the world sees it. But see, if I lost this tonight, even though it's a lovely thing, I would not be the less for it. But my sobriety is a pearl of great price. And if you think about a pearl is formed in the shell of an oyster shell gets a crack in it, and some sand gets in there, and by pain and irritation, the oyster must set up some kind of a saliva substance to seal that shell over. And it's formed then what we know as a pearl. It's formed by pain and irritation. Wouldn't you say that our sobriety was earned by pain and irritation of the nth degree? And so don't throw your pearl of great price away. All right, so we are blessed enough to get into a meeting like this, or meetings all over the world. Dear God, it always amazes me. I look at my watch and know at home, right at this same time, somebody's up at a microphone talking at my home meeting. People will be saying the Lord's Prayer approximately the same time, reading the 12 steps. Oh, God, it's better than any booze I ever had. This tickles me half to death. And so we come in here and we just love the people. That's what I love the most. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I weighed 82 pounds. I was suffering from malnutrition. I looked about 65 years old. I was totally insane. I was terrorized, totally terrorized. And when I walked through the doors of North Hollywood, the Radford group was my home group, no one in that meeting said to me, "My God, put some weight on," or "Calm your makeup down," or "How much money do you have? What kind of a car do you drive? You know, you have to qualify in any other club for all this." They didn't say anything. They just put their warm arms around me and accepted me totally as I was for the first time in my life. Not as I would be, could be, or should be, but as I was. And Bonnie talked about it. You know what it is? It's called agape love. A-G-A-P-E. That's God's kind of love. Unconditional. We don't care how old you are. We don't care what color you are. Where you came from, young or old, female or male, makes no difference. If you're an alcoholic, oh, dear one, you're in the right place, and we love you no matter where you've been. And if you're willing to do something about it, we'll go to hell for you. If you're not, go to hell by yourself, you know. I'll do anything for anybody who doesn't want to drink, but if you want to drink, have fun. So we come in here, and my weight came back on, and I started looking better, and things started getting better, and I became the secretary of a group, and I made 12-step calls. I went to meetings 365 nights. I fell in love with my voice at an early age, and the love affair is still going on. And they found out I could speak, and so they put me on the circuit. When I was 49 days dry, I went on the circuit. Oh, obviously you people don't know who you got up here talking tonight, do you? Everything was wonderful. But there came a time in my life when I had to say to myself, is that all there is to Alcoholics Anonymous? Is that all there is to sobriety? Well, if that's all there is, let's break out the booze and have a little drink. You've heard that song that Peggy Lee sings, haven't you? Is that all there is? Let's break out the booze and have a ball. Oh, she belongs to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm sure she should get in here sometime. Or the person who wrote the song. What happens? Why do you come in here and the blush, they say, you went on a honeymoon, everything's wonderful, and then you come down off the honeymoon. What happens? Why do we come in here and get the monkey off our back and all of a sudden say, well, it's kind of cold out tonight, I think I'll stay home, or gee, there's a good television program on, or it's raining, or it's not raining. It's hot, or it's cold, or I'm tired. You know, if everybody in Portland, Oregon, in this immediate area, had been diagnosed as having cancer today, and were told by the doctor they couldn't cure it, but they could arrest it, and that if they went to a meeting two or three nights a week from, say, 8:30 to 10, drank some coffee and lied to each other a little bit, that we could arrest this cancer. My God, there wouldn't be meeting places in Southern California, Oregon, for the people that would come. And they'd never be too tired. There'd never be a program too important on television to keep them here if they thought for 1 minute that they could break out in this cancer. Well, they only have one part of the disease. Now, we have two, right? But if you ever get to the place where you say to yourself, is that all there is? My God, am I going to have to go sit on those hard chairs all the rest of my life? You will then know that you have missed the most important part, in my opinion, to the disease called alcoholism. And that is the spiritual illness. Too many people don't talk about it, dear ones. And yet, see, I'll quote you the book. It says we have a threefold disease, an allergy of the body, coupled with an obsession of the mind, and a spiritual illness. And many people don't do it, and I sure didn't. I was so afraid of God, I didn't even mention him. You know, don't do that. I have a photographic memory. I memorized the 12 steps. My sponsor was a book woman. She'd quote the book. I'd run home and read the book and quote it too. So I taught it. I preached it. I read it. I recited it. I memorized it. I did everything but work it. That ain't the name of the game. And so the spiritual illness is what I think we do neglect very much. And I'll quote you some things from the book. I'm not an authority. If I gave you my ideas, you might go out and get drunk, because they got me drunk. But the things I tell you are things that I've learned from this program and from the people and from the book. And it tells me this, that no human power can relieve alcoholism, but God can and will if he sought. Now, if a human power could relieve alcoholism, I would walk over here to this beautiful little new girl and I'd give her a big hunk of sobriety tonight. And the one that's sitting over here. Or any of the rest of you, if a human power can relieve alcoholism, I'll do it. But no human power can do it, but God can and will if he sought. Now, it also tells me that as I get well spiritually, the physical and the emotional will follow. Isn't it strange? It doesn't say get well physically and then the spiritual and the emotional will follow. Book says when you get well spiritually. Now, I believe this, and what I say tonight is my own opinion. You'll find out I'm terribly opinionated before I'm through. But my idea is this, that we are wounded right here at the center of our being. Terribly wounded people. How you get that way is not important tonight. You'll find out. But if you're like I am, you'll put all kinds of dirty bandages on there. You'll put sex and marriage and divorce and kids and houses and money and property and prestige and popularity. You'll put everything on there. And for a little while, it seems to stop that. And you think, oh, I finally found it. I finally found something that makes me not hurt anymore. Within a very short time, you're hurting again. And all we're doing is just scabbing over. And somebody can come along and pick the scab and we're hurt again. Now, when you come to Alcoholics Anonymous, if you're smart, you'll open your ears and you'll listen and you'll let us pull the dirty bandages off of you. Oh, it's going to hurt. And then we'll put a clean bandage on you called Alcoholics Anonymous. And you'll start to get well from the inside out. You won't just scab over. Any bandage you put on your wound will stop the pain for a short time. We wouldn't think of going along and finding a dirty bandage full of pus on the ground and putting it on a wound. You say, oh my God, sterilize that thing. And yet think in your lifetime, dear hearts, think how many dirty bandages you put on your wounds, trying somehow to feel comfortable. You know the reason we drink? To feel comfortable. We belong to the cult of the comfortable. We almost kill ourselves trying to get that way. But that's all I ever wanted. I didn't want to get drunk. I only wanted a little drink. I took a little drunk, but I only wanted a little drink to feel comfortable so I wouldn't hurt so much anymore. Now, for a long time, alcohol took care of that. But as with most things that are of a detrimental nature, it started to kick the hell out of me after a while, and I had to find something else to put on there. I also believe that we are insatiable. There is never enough for you and I. I believe that alcoholics grow up physically. I believe we grow up mentally. I don't think you'll find one dummy in Alcoholics Anonymous. The dummies are out there saying, nothing wrong with me, wrong with me, wrong with me. But really, really and truly, you don't find dumb people in Alcoholics Anonymous. We are so highly emotional, easily upset, and very sensitive. And I love every minute of it, don't you? But we are that way. And so in the center of my being, I don't know, maybe you don't identify with this, I have a great big mouth. And it's hungry all the time. There's never enough love. There's never enough pets. There's never enough compliments. Never enough kisses. Never enough of anything. But when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, after I drank again, and I'll tell you about that, and I finally started to work on the third part of my disease, the spiritual illness, I found out one day, praise God, that that mouth started to close. And all of a sudden it closed, and it was comfortable. Oh, dear God, I was comfortable for the first time in my whole life. And I could take a breath, and it went from my nose all the way down here. It wasn't that little shallow breath that I had anymore. And then I started getting well. Because now I'm attacking this mysterious disease on three levels. Now, my first entrance into Alcoholics Anonymous was 31 years ago. I was just 8 years old. You understand that, don't you? You sure know how to hurt a lady, I'll tell you that, with those dirty laughs out there. And I stayed on this program for around this program for 16 months. I shot for a first birthday. My God, I tell you, I couldn't wait to get that first birthday cake. All I had in my idea was to stand up there on that podium and get that cake, and you'd be down there looking at me, and I'd be a star. I walked in the shadow of a very talented sister. My older sister was 2 years older than I am. She was a radio singer, junior champion skier, and a model, and my mother simply adored her. Then I had a baby sister 9 years younger, so I was kind of lost in there, but I'd sit in audiences and watch my sister get roses when she sang. I saw her get cups when she'd ski, and I'd see her, you know, with these gorgeous clothes on and everything when she was modeling, and I never could make it. And so in North Hollywood, they have kind of like a stage, and I just sat there that first night and thought, geez, all I have to do is not drink for a year, and I'll be up there, and then you guys will be down there looking up at me, and I'll have my big night. Well, I worked so hard that first year. My God, 3 months after I was sober, I went back to work, and I had two daughters and a husband and an apartment, and I went out every night during the week. I spoke two or three nights a week and went to 365 meetings that first year. Well, during this first year, the people loved me so much, and they were so good to me. And they started telling me how wonderful I was, and I started to agree with them. And that was to be my downfall. You know, something will get you drunk faster than the first drink is your ego, don't you? By the way, ego is spelled E-G-O, edging God out. I believe it to be so true. When you get full of your own importance, when you really think you're something rather than what God has used you for, you're in trouble. Because I sure was. I really jumped on, a cloud 199. I think that we're split personalities, you and I. I think we're split right down the middle. I think this side of our personality said, oh, I'm so dumb, and I'm so stupid, and I'm so ugly, and if anybody's going to get fired, it's going to be me. But this side of my personality says, I'm so gorgeous, and I'm such a sponsor. Oh, you're so lucky to have me in AA, you know. And the old pendulum swings back and forth till I get thrown off balance. So when I came here, I was totally on this side of my personality, totally inferior. Couldn't make a decision, couldn't arrange my hair by myself, couldn't pick out a dress by myself. Couldn't make the simplest decision of put a sweater or a coat on my kids, and if I put a coat on them and they came home carrying it, then everybody knew how dumb I was. I was totally self-obsessed in a ball, in a big house of mirrors that I lived in. But as I came to you people and you started loving me, instead of being stuck over here on the inferiority side, it started to swing a little bit to the center. Now, if it had stayed there, I'd have been all right. But it didn't. I shot to the egocentric side of my personality. Which reminds me of a story, by the way. There's a guy talking about if we went out of this restaurant tonight through that door over there and there was somebody standing by that door with a baseball bat to hit us on the head, we wouldn't even think of going out this door. We'd go out that door every night, and if we got there some night and he wasn't there, we'd wait for him. Love that. No middle of the road for you and I, kid. So as they began to tell me how wonderful I was, I began to agree with them. I thought, boy, I finally found some people who know how good I am. And the year went by on the wings. On February the 8th, 1951, I stood up there at the podium at North Hollywood. Oh, I had a corsage stuck out about that big. My family sat in the front row. I got more presents than I'd ever gotten any natal birthday. And again, they told me how wonderful I was. And again, I said, thank you very much. I'm glad you understand how good I am. I had rehearsed my acceptance speech for 6 months. It was magnificent. You should have heard it. And I guess I thought I'd graduated. Really did. Now, after this first year, a lot of crazy things went through my life. I didn't know until I looked back. I have 20/20 vision hindsight. I looked back, and I saw me break my meeting pattern. And if there was a good television program on, I stayed home. My sponsor wouldn't give me 3 hours of undivided attention on the phone anymore, and I got mad at her, so I wouldn't call her anymore. I went to a meeting in Azusa. Have any of you ever heard of Azusa? Boy, the rain was coming down, and the windshield wiper wouldn't even take the rain off. And I drove there, and I got there. And there's a meeting about half as big as this place, and there was a couple of old people sitting there when I walked in. 8:30 comes along, and six old people are there. And I'm sitting thinking, how dare they ask the great Dottie Shore to come to speak to six old people? So I left there very angry. And from then on, when they called me, I asked them how big the group was. If it was a big group, I went. If it was a small group, I sent one of my babies. I got them started, you know. I couldn't be bothered with that small-time stuff. Now, I did then what I think is the most unforgivable thing, if there be such a thing in AA, that anyone can do, and that's turn down 12-step calls. Now, in my own defense, I'll tell you I didn't let them go. But see, I'm too big time calling those new drunks. By the way, you know what an old-timer is? A person who will fly 3,000 miles to make a talk but won't go across the street to help a drunk. That's an old-timer. And so I was just filled up with my own importance, and I was very angry. Now, I had never taken an inventory. I thought alcohol was my problem, and I hadn't had a problem with alcohol. So no reason to take an inventory. As far as the higher power is concerned, my sponsor was my higher power. I had a very fearful God, and so she was very kind and good to me, so she was my higher power. Now, for the next 3 months after I had my first year, I started going downhill. My ex-husband said I started saying things like, I might as well be drunk as the way I am. Those SBs are like everybody else. They take you and squeeze you dry and throw you away after they've used you up. He was really upset, wondering what was wrong. There's no Al-Anon in those days down there. Well, on June the 10th, 1951, I went to a beginner's meeting, and about 15 people raised their hand as newcomers. And the leader said, you are the most important people in the room. And I thought, like hell they are. Now, you lose an old-timer like me, you know. I've got 16 months. You've lost something. But those new drunks, if we lose them, we haven't lost too much. Oh. So when the meeting was over, I just split. I always liked the meeting before and after. I don't know about you guys. But I went home, and I'm so angry, just livid with anger. And I thought, I know what I'll do. I'll punish them. I'll make them sorry for the way they treated me. I'll get drunk, and then they'll be sorry. And I went into total fantasy. And my mind says, well, you'll get sick. And I thought I always had. What's new about that? But the door to AA swings both ways, doesn't it? I'll get drunk, and then they'll be sorry, and then I'll come back, and then it'll be over with, and everything will be fine. I was going to put the bottle on the coffee table, put my feet up there, and get drunk, and if my husband didn't like it, tell him to go to hell. Now, I could see him coming home, finding me a little drunk, and being shocked, and going to the phone, calling the North Hollywood Clubhouse. And he's saying to him, my God, she's drunk, and they're saying, oh, no. And then they get in a caravan of cars and come over in 12 steps. And when they get there, they make amends, and I forgive them, you know. Oh, my. Then they pick me up in their warm arms, and they take me back to North Hollywood, and I'm a newcomer again. Oh, it was a gorgeous fantasy. I got up the next morning on June the 11th, 1951. I cleaned my house because I wouldn't have them calling any slob. You understand that? I put on my makeup and my earrings and combed my hair and had my stage all set. And I walked to the liquor store. I didn't drive because, see, I used to drive in blackouts, but I didn't know they were blackouts until you told me. I thought when 4 hours went by, I was just terribly preoccupied, you know, thinking very heavy, and I didn't know where I was at these times. So I walked to the liquor store, and I bought the same half pint. Now, I have 16 months and 3 days. A circuit speaker. I want you to understand who I'm talking about now. And I walked home, and when you're married to a non-alcoholic, you non-alcoholics know this, if they can find your bottle, God help you, they'll pour it down the sink every time. And when you buy your bottle out of the grocery money, you know, that gets kind of sticky after a bit. So in about 2 years before I came to AA, I had to find a place to hide the supply. And I found that vinegar and bourbon are the same color. So I was not a fancy drunk, dear. I drank out of a vinegar bottle for the last 2.5 years of my drinking. But I poured the vinegar out, put the whiskey in the bottle, and I put the vinegar right up in the front of the cupboard. Then I stand back. He'd come home and I was a little too drunk. He'd start going through the cupboard and he'd push that vinegar bottle back and forth. never did find my supply. Never did. Well, now I'm 16 months and 3 days, the great circus speaker, right? Going to be different, right? Wrong. I went home, took the vinegar out of the shelf, poured it in the sink, poured my whiskey in the vinegar bottle, and took my first drink out of the vinegar bottle. That's how much I changed. Well, let me tell you, when that whiskey burned my throat, dear God, if someone had slapped me and wakened me out of a sound sleep, it couldn't have been more violent. And I thought, oh, my God, what have I done? There goes 16 months of sobriety shot to hell. And I stood absolutely terrorized, waiting for something to happen. And nothing happened. And I thought, I knew all along I wasn't like those drunks over there. And I made a grave mistake. When I first got to AA, I heard a man talk about drinking fifths a day in sanitariums and jails and 502s and 86s and convulsions, losing the family. And I thought, oh, my God, I'm not like that. I scared myself into this group. Don't identify with a drinking pattern. You may not be able to identify with my drinking pattern tonight. Oh, I beg you to identify with a thinking pattern. That's why you're laughing when I talk. Because you know exactly what I'm like. You're as crazy as I am. That's why I love you. But that's true. The stinking thinking leads to the drinking. And I had a terrible time trying to identify with drinking patterns. I listened to all these heavy drinking, and I thought, God, I'm not like those people. I didn't drink that much, that long, do those things. So when that whiskey burned my throat, immediately I thought, well, you know, I'm not like you people. I went out in the kitchen to have what I thought was going to be my second drink. Now, what I tell you now is told to me by my sponsor and my husband. He was an outside salesman, and he knew I was squirreled up, so he broke off the territory at 11 o'clock that morning. He came home, and he heard me screaming a half a block before he got to the house. When he opened the door and came in, I was on the floor kicking and beating my heels till I almost broke the bones in my feet. I had dry heaves till I broke a blood vessel into my esophagus, and I'm vomiting blood from my mouth and my nose. And my eyes, there's no whites left. I ruptured the blood vessels in my eyes. And when he tried to get me up off the floor, I stopped breathing. And he just tore out of the house. He had a car, but he remembered only that it was a medical center 2 blocks from where we lived. And we'd only lived in the house a short time, so he went up there, and there were 7 doors along a sidewalk. He came to the very first door that was available, and the office was full of people. He crashed past that and past the receptionist into the doctor's examining room, and he grabbed him and said, "My wife's been sober 16 months, and she's drinking. I think she's dying. Will you please come?" And dear God, the first of many miracles was set forth for me, because that doctor didn't say, "Get the rescue squad," or "Am I got another drunk," or "Do you have hospitalization," or "Who recommended you?" You know, any of the things they usually say, or "Fill out this form." He just didn't say a word. He picked up his bag and ran the 2 blocks back to my home. And do you know why? He was an alcoholic. One of 7 doctors in that building, and the only one that was an alcoholic that would have come. And when he put the stethoscope on my chest, he turned to my husband and he said, "All vital signs are gone. I'm sorry. No heartbeat, no pulse, no respiration. She's OD'd on a drug called alcohol." And my husband got hysterical. And the doctor said, "I'll try one thing more." And he took a long needle out of his bag and he shot me directly in the chest cavity. And he gave me artificial resuscitation. And by the grace of God, I started breathing. Now let's take it back. Supposing Al had been 5 minutes late, 1 minute late coming home. The doctor hesitated 2 minutes. They could have brought my heart back. But there'd been absolutely no repairing of the brain damage that would have happened to me. And the total amount of alcohol I had that morning, dear friends, was 3 straight shots of booze. Most people spill more than that, don't they? I had to learn the hardest way an alcoholic can learn. It's not how much you drink, how long you drink, what brand, with whom. That doesn't constitute alcoholism. It's, can you guarantee what's going to happen when you take your next drink? Everyone in this room who's an alcoholic has another drunk in them. But dear God, you don't know how if you have any more sobering up time left. You just don't know. Now, I believe that when you come to AA the first time, you're presented with some invisible pieces of paper. Now, whether they have 1, 5, or 10, I don't know. I only had 1. I call it sobering up time. I punch for the last ticket. For me to drink is to die. Thank God I know it. Thank God I know it. I have no more drunks left. I don't want to ever go out that way again. And so I'm what the book says, I became willing if only the dying can to do the things necessary for sobriety. I was sedated all night long. My rupture into the blood vessel was in my esophagus was going, and I can remember barely waking up and getting some bitter tasting medicine and going back to sleep. And I woke up the next morning
I tried to open my eyes, and I couldn't. My face was swelled. You talk about poison. And my husband left the two girls in the room that next morning. Oh, dear God, here's these two kids standing at the foot of my bed. They'd been to AA. The house had quieted down. Mother was not ranting and raving like a crazy woman. And here they're standing there looking just absolutely terrorized. And my oldest daughter said, Mother, will you do us a favor? And I thought it was going to be to promise not to drink. And I said, I'll do anything if you won't be mad. And she brought the AA book out from behind her back, and she read to me the preamble and the 12 steps. And I'm quite sure you've heard the words pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And I used to think that was, you know, losing your pants out in public or something, or vomiting on the table, you know, something terrible. My pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization was seeing my two daughters stand at the foot of my bed with more faith in this program than I had. And they gave me a kiss when they left and went to school. Now, I didn't remember hearing anything more about those steps than I had any other time. I used to sit in meetings for 16 months and think, my God, they're going to read those damn things again? Well, it's for those ding-a-lings, the real sickies, they have to read that. And I wouldn't listen. And I didn't hear my daughter read much more either, but I heard these words for 2 days. Over and over, like a record with a needle stuck in it, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed the path. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed the path. Before I got out of bed, dear hearts, I knew I hadn't slipped. There's no such a word. I knew I didn't have a little research to do. I knew that I'd failed a God-given program called Alcoholics Anonymous. In my opinion, it's infallible. But we'll fail it. And why? Because I did not thoroughly follow the path. Now, I got no place to go but up. When you're down that far, there's no place to go but up. Went to the doctor a couple days later, and he said, I want you to listen to me, and I want you to hear me good. You are as dead as anybody I've ever examined, and why you're here, I don't know. But if you ever touch another drop of alcohol again, you'll die. And the very first thought that went through my mind is, why didn't you just let me go? You know, the world has been very... I don't do well out in the world. I don't know about you guys. I don't do well out there. It's all been kind of hard for me. And so I thought, if he'd just let me go, I'd have my out. Now, the world is not hard anymore because I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous. And nothing can go down in my life that I don't have an answer for. I don't have 1,000 people that I can call to come to me. I was thinking about Monday and the attempted assassination of President Reagan. It made me sick to my stomach. Not that I care that much for Reagan, but he is the President of the United States. And I think, I can't stand it out there. But you see, we come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and no one has told me about the price of gasoline. When the thing was on, nobody said he's going to vote for Reagan or Carter. We never talk about the world. Oh, thank God. Thank God we talk about, how's it with you? You know, you're doing all right. How do you feel? Can I help you? I think it's the only reason Alcoholics Anonymous has been successful where everything else has failed. Because you taught me how to live. You taught me how to roll with life. You helped me get that mouth closed up so I wasn't terribly ravagingly hungry all the time. You saved my life and you saved my sanity. And I thank God from the bottom of my heart tonight that I'm an alcoholic. Sober and Alcoholics Anonymous. Because had I never become an alcoholic, I could have been born, lived, and died. A total hopeless neurotic. Running through people's lives like a tornado, a big blob taking up space. But do you know something? I'm a great person because I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a child of God. I'm Dottie Shore, sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Hey, you can't get better than that. Today, I helped somebody. Did you? Did you put your hand out and help somebody today? I don't care if they're alcoholic or not. My hand's out to anybody that's in trouble. It's hurting if I can make their life a little bit better. If it's the milkman or the paper man or the grocery store man. Oh, I never did that before I got you people. All I wanted is, what are you going to do for me? Gimme, 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 and I never got full. I never got full. I was always insatiable. God, what a program this is. What a wonderful, wonderful thing this is. And you and I got the part of it. Isn't that marvelous? Aren't we fortunate? Aren't we blessed? Well, the second thought that hit my mind was, there must be something God wants me to do. Else, why did he leave me here? And I think it was about June 13th, 1951. And I said, all right, Lord, I commit myself to this program. I will never be too tired, nor too busy, to answer a call for anyone. And the reason I said anyone is I tried to talk to the migraine headache people who are hooked on drugs, and the ulcer patients with 3/4 of their stomach removed in pharmacy. And I would try to help them across the counter. And that's why 10 years ago I started that group. Now I've been used in Overeaters Anonymous as much as I've been in AA. I'm not a compulsive overeater. These people do the same thing you and I do. They just eat or we drink. Their basic problem is the same. It's been the easiest commitment, dear hearts, I've ever made in my life. The happiest journey I've ever been on. See, I lived from goal to goal to goal to goal all my life. And I missed the journey on the way to the goal. And then AA tells me that spiritual progress is my goal. Oh, hallelujah, what a deal to go through. I'll never reach the goal, but the journey is magnificent. Totally magnificent. Oh, it took me a long time. Dear God, it took me a long time to get that crackpot off that cloud, throw away those books, close up that hell hole he was going to put me in. But you see, I came to get sober. I didn't want to die drunk. And each and every one of you gave me God. Each and every one of you gave me a little bit of your belief until finally I could put it together in a composite form, and I now have a God of my understanding. I was looking around everywhere trying to find a higher power. I was born and raised a Roman Catholic, and I'm sad to say that I was taught by a practicing alcoholic priest who terrorized me, totally terrorized me. And when I was 16 years old, I ran away to get and got married to a 17-year-old boy to get away from this talented sister and the baby sister and the unpaid babysitter bit. And I married this kid, and he didn't have a job. He ended up living with my mother. I didn't get away very far that time. He reminded me of Bonnie. She didn't get away very far either. And 2 months after I'm married, I'm pregnant with my oldest daughter. Now, the kid didn't want a baby. He wanted me to have an abortion. He said, put the child in more like a brother or a sister. And I can understand that. I hated him at one time. But he was only 17 years old. And so I made up my mind I was going to have this child. And I went ahead and had her. I was happy for the first time in my life when I carried that baby. I felt like I was worth something. But you know, no more than jumped out of the womb till I'm praying for God's sake for her to grow up and get out of my hair. I'm scared death of her. And he wouldn't hold her. And so I didn't go home to my mother because I was already there. I just kicked him out. Now, I was born and raised in Reno, and my grandfather homesteaded in Reno and built the courthouse and many of the churches. So we lived right across the street from the Roman Catholic Church. And one day, this alcoholic priest was up there walking up and down doing his office. And he came over to me and he said, when are you going to have the baby baptized? And I said, not till I get married again. Oh, I'm really smart. You know, you don't tell a priest that, but I did. And he said, you can't get married again. If you do, you'll be living in adultery, and you tell her that issue will be illegitimate. And so I pulled myself up in my self-will, and I said, well, I'm going to get married. He said, you're excommunicated. Well, if God had said you're excommunicated, it couldn't be any more official as far as I was concerned. So for the next 19 years, I wandered the face of this earth like a lost soul. I did get married again. Al and I had a daughter. Unfortunately, she was a very sick child, and for the next 7 years, we never expected her to live. Dear ones, you know how many times I went to a funeral in my mind? How many times I went down to a morgue and picked up a little pink casket and little gold shoes? A little white dress and just milked this neurotic, morbid imagination? Would go home and close her door? Wouldn't anybody get in there and touch her toys? Cobwebs together? You know how many times when my husband was late coming home from work, it was the time that he was going to be killed? And it was the police at the door asking if I'm Mrs. Shore. They put me in a car and take me down to the morgue and pull out this slab with this mangled body. You know how many times I did that in my lifetime? Thank God for alcohol. If I hadn't found alcohol, I'd have gone straight to the top of my head. And so I come to Alcoholics Anonymous now, and you tell me to turn my life and my will over to care of who? You're kidding me, aren't you? You're not going to play that dirty trick on me, are you? Well, I went to my sponsor, and I said, I can't work the third step, and if I don't work the third step, I'll get drunk. What am I going to do? And she says, why can't you do it? And I said, I'm afraid of God. She says, tell me about your God. And I started, and she said, oh, stop, let's run. I'm afraid of him, too.
Well, all righty. So I went over to North Hollywood, and I'm game. So I said to the first guy, how do you believe in God? And he said, oh, you mean the old man upstairs? I thought, oh, my God, that's blasphemy. You don't talk about God like that. Because this priest said you have to say thee and thou and do this, you know, hold your nose on your third finger and do all this stuff right. So I left him alone and asked this guy, how do you believe in God? He said, oh, you mean my pal Joe? Oh, my God, that's even worse. You know, we're all going to go, to hell. And so a man was watching all this go on, and he pulled me aside, and he said, Dottie, do you really want to find God? And I said, oh, with all my heart. He said, will you do as I'm telling, going to tell you to do? I said, I will. He said, all right, don't ask anybody anymore because you're going to get upset. He said, I want you to pray one prayer for a week. I want you to say, God, reveal yourself to me as you really are. And then start looking. Well, that seemed about the easiest thing I'd heard. So I'm game. And without exaggeration, dear friends, I must have prayed that prayer 100 times a day. And during the week, as the week went by, a lot of things happened. I was telling Marty today, I'm a cloud freak, in case you want to know. But for the first time in my life, I saw clouds. And Reno has beautiful skies, an awful lot like Oregon. And I thought, no man got up and pumped those clouds up with any, you know, kind of a pump this morning, so maybe that's God. I went to a meeting during this week, and a man said, if you're having trouble finding God, take the word good, take one O out of it, and you have God. Anything that's good is God. Now, I said, if you go outside tomorrow morning and the sun's out, you're not surprised because it's hot. You don't say, gee, the sun's cold this morning. Can't be. By its very nature, the sun is a hot thing. Now, I said, God, by his very nature, can't be good and bad, punishing and rewarding. By his very nature, he's all good. Oh, that was so comforting. And so I went home, and I'm still saying the prayer, I don't know how many times a day. And then I went to a meeting, I guess about the fifth day, and I heard a man talk on a subject I've never heard him talk on before or since, and I used to follow him all over the valley. He said, I'm going to tell you about the prodigal son, and I'm going to tell you in kind of an AA jargon. He said, now once there was a young kid who decided he didn't want to wait for the old man to kick the bucket. He said, went to him, and he claimed his inheritance. And the father weepingly gave it to him, and he got on a horse, and he ran to a far country. And he spent it on wine, women, and song. He said, I think he was a little alcoholic. Now, while he was in this deplorable state, there was a famine in the country. And he had nothing to eat. So he went to the pig master, and he asked the pig master if he could feed the pigs, could he have something to eat or some salary? And the pig master said, you can feed the pigs and eat what's left over. So this kid gets in the pig pen. And I said, this is a bad spot, because this kid's a Jew, and that's an awful place for a Jew to be, is in the pig pen. I've heard the prodigal son before, too, but I hadn't heard it like this. And he said, while he's in the pig pen chewing on these corn husks, he thinks, God, you know, his father treats servants so good. They have a clean bed of straw and they have something to eat. He knew he'd lost the right to be a son, but maybe he could go home and be a servant. So he said he got up and he shuffled and he stumbled home to the father. Now, the father was out in the field working and he saw him a long way off and he came to greet him. And he put his arms around him, threw a cloak on his shoulder. He didn't say to him, my God, you stink. Get in there and take a shower and then come back out here and we'll talk about this thing. He didn't say a word. He just was so grateful that he was home. And he put a ring of acceptance on his finger. Now, the kid tried to tell him all the rotten things he had done. And he hushed him up. He didn't tell him to go out in the back 40 and cultivate the land for 30 days in penance. He said, it is enough that my son was dead and he's alive, that he's lost and now returned. And there was great celebration in the killing of the fatted calf over one kid who had been lost and now returned. And on the way home that night, I thought, surely to God, I'm the prodigal child. I'd gone to AA and I'd claimed my inheritance, my pearl of great price, and I'd thrown it away. End up on my own front room floor, vomiting blood and dying. Maybe all I had to do was to shuffle up the 12 steps home to the Father, and maybe he would see me the long way off and he'd come to greet me. And you know that he did. But before this was to take place, about the sixth day, I'm having a bad time trying to get this father deal in there because my mother was a dominating matriarch. She was just a dominating woman, and my father was kind of like a faceless figure. So I didn't have a father-daughter identification whatsoever. But I tried to think of all the fathers that my girlfriends had that was good and trying to get a composite picture. And while I was doing this, my memory bank opened up, and I remembered a man that I was raised next door to when I was 9, 10 years old. My girlfriend's name was Madeline, and her mother had died when she was born, so this grandfather and grandmother raised her, and she called her grandfather Daddy Dick. Now, I was over there playing more than I was home, and I went back later and talked to Mrs. Yates, and she said that I was a very deprived child, that I was lost in that family, and that she loved to have me, so I'd be over there many times. Now, when I was there, Daddy Dick would grab me and put me on his lap and lay my head on his shoulder, and he would say to me, you know, Dottie, if you ever need anything, just ask Daddy Dick. It puts a lump in my throat tonight because he's the only one that ever gave me total acceptance till I got to you people. And this old man did do a lot of things for me. And I'm thinking, maybe I could have a daddy God. Maybe I could climb up in the lap of Daddy God and lay my head on his shoulder, and he would say to me, "You know, Dottie, if you ever need anything, just ask Daddy God." Seventh day came. Still a little uneasy because I think I'm being too familiar. You're not supposed to talk to God like this, are you? So my sponsor used to say if I was upset, either open the AA book and put my finger down, or open the Bible and put my finger down, and start to read. So I thought, well, this is a spiritual question. So I opened the Bible and I put my finger down, and these are the words that came off the page. "You who are human parents, full of sin, if your children ask you for a piece of bread, would you give them a stone? They ask you for a fish, would you give them a serpent? How much more will your heavenly Father grant to those who believe in him?" And it was just like he was saying, "It's okay, Dottie." And on the seventh day, I found my Daddy God. And I wish I had time tonight to tell you about him. He's never mocked me. He's never broken his word. He doesn't show favoritism. He's never turned away from me. Never left me comfortless. He's closer than my breathing. He's nearer than my hands and feet. Then I started getting well. Then the missing link was set into place. Now I have a God of my understanding. As I got well spiritually, the physical and the emotional started to follow. And many wonderful things were to take place. Now, I'd like to tell you that everything's been wonderful since then, but it's not true. The days did become weeks, the weeks became months, the months became years. And by the grace of God, and if the creek don't rise, on June the 11th this year, I'll have 30 years of continuous sobriety. You got to know you've seen a miracle tonight. You see, I never did anything successfully or finished anything. Oh, I'm a hell of an enthusiast. I'll start to knit a sweater and I'll knit till 2 o'clock in the morning and never finish it. I'll do everything real gung-ho. Why do you suppose I've never gotten tired of Alcoholics Anonymous? Why do you suppose I don't get bored? Why do you suppose at long last, thank God, I don't say, "Is that all there is?" I just can't get enough. I fell in love with this program. I'm really in love with this program. I'm in love with the people. I think I'm the most fortunate of human beings. Now, I'm going to tell you a few things that happened since I've been sober. I don't like old-timers to get up here and tell you, "Well, I had an awful time when I was drinking, dear hearts, but I got sober and I sailed off into sunset." That's not fair. People will look at me sometimes and say, "Gee, Dottie, I wish I had it all together like you." I'll say, "Hey, you don't live with me. You don't know what I have, what I go through. And I do have it together better, but no one has it all together. Jesus said in this world there'll be trials and tribulations. He didn't say it was going to be easy. And it hasn't been. One of the nicest things I've had happen to me, I think, outside of my sobriety was 5 years ago, I was presented anonymously with a paid trip to the Holy Land. Oh, what a trip. What a wonderful time. I'm now a born-again Christian. I was a Christian before I left, but now I know the difference of just saying it and being one. And I love it. I'm not religious. Spare me from religion. Religion almost killed me. But I am a spiritual person, and I love every minute of it. But when the time since I've been sober now, the first thing that went down, I got a call at midnight one night, and my mother said, "Dottie, Evelyn died tonight." And my beautiful, talented sister, the radio singer, junior champion skier, and a model, blew apart from cirrhosis of the liver. Tried for 3 years to help her and couldn't. I had to go home to a drunken Irish wake. Everybody in my family got drunk. My mother got so drunk she fell off the chair. And my sister's dead of alcoholism, with her head swelled about the size of both shoulders. You know, alcoholism is not a pretty death. I stood there looking at her, and I thought the script was wrong. Shouldn't be Evelyn there and old dumb Dottie up here. It should be the other way around. You know, talented Evelyn doing everything and dumb Dottie dead. I thought, if the script's wrong, what's going on? And through my mind went the words, "We cease to fight everything and everybody, including alcohol." The only fight I ever gave up was booze. But I won. And my sister, the last word she said on this physical plane is she blew apart. They removed 7 ribs in a 4-hour operation. The last word she said, she came out of the anesthetic, is, "Bill, I want a drink," and died. And she kept on fighting and she died. I came back to California, and a very few short years after that, my oldest daughter became an addict alcoholic. And she's smashing her life away, and my grandson is a basket case. So I take my grandson from her, and when I took my grandson from her, because he was going down the drain with her, she walked out of her apartment and walked away and disappeared off the face of the earth. Now, I've got to tell you about Al-Anon. Thank God for Al-Anon. Oh, thank God for Al-Anon. They saved my sanity. They truly saved my sanity. I went to Al-Anon meetings. I've never had so much love and compassion and understanding. Well, I got along pretty well. But about 8 months go by, and I don't know if my daughter's dead or alive. I'm spoon-feeding my grandson little bits of AA. He was sucking his thumb and wetting the bed, and he's finally stopping doing that, and he's calming down. But I'm waking up at 2, 3 o'clock in the morning with a smothering sensation like I got a pillow over my face. And I can't get my breath, and I thought, my God, I must be having a heart attack or something. So I went to the doctor. He gave me a thorough examination. There was nothing physically wrong. He said to me, you better go to a psychiatrist. This is an emotional problem you have. Well, on the way home from the doctor's, I thought, I was working with a girl whose husband was an Episcopal priest, and he was a good member of Al-Anon. Father Ken was his name, and so I thought, I think I'll go talk to Father Ken. So I went over and I said, Father Ken, what do you think's wrong with me? He said, Dottie, you sound like you're in a panic. What are you afraid of? And I started to cry. I said, I'm afraid I'll never see Anne alive again. He said, you must accept the fact you will never see her alive again. And I said, but I can't. He said, then go on fighting. And again, that sentence, you cease to fight everything and everybody, including alcohol, went through my mind. So I went home, and I got on my knees, and I said something like this. All right, Lord, I don't understand how it can be your will. But if it is indeed your will that I never see Anne alive again, I surrender her to you, even unto her death. Just give me the strength to go through it. And dear hearts, it was like a load went off my shoulders. And I finished the day and went to bed that night, and I slept for the first night in 8 months straight through without waking up. Woke up the next day and was about my business, and the phone rang at noon. And it was my daughter. Now, if you call that a coincidence, I call that a complicated way of spelling God. She didn't get well right away, but we had a chance then to be at least in contact, and eventually I was to find someone that could take her and taper her off her drugs. She was more addict than alcoholic, and she couldn't cold turkey it. It would put her into convulsions, and we finally got her straightened around. I must say it because sometimes I forget. She's now 15 years clean and sober on this program. Thank God. Thank God. Thank God. When she got well and came back into our life, I had Greg for many years after that. But when she came back, we were talking one day, and we were talking about surrender. And she was saying how difficult it was for her to surrender, you know, to leave drugs alone. And I told her that the biggest surrender I ever had was when I surrendered her even unto death. She said to me, when was that, Mother? And I told her. We pieced the thing back together again. The very day. If you hear nothing else, I say, listen to this. The very day that I surrendered her even unto death was the day she went into Tijuana, Mexico to pick up her drugs. Now, when she got in there, you could usually go to a drugstore and ask for 1,000 anything. But the Hell's Angels had been picked up going across the border. And so when she went into the drugstore to get her drugs, they didn't know what she was talking about. Boy, they closed down tight. Well, it's not quite like going to another liquor store, you know, if they're out of liquor. And she was burned out and she was tired. She got in her car and drove back to the valley. She'd been right living very close to us all this time, and I didn't know it. And she blocked all the doors and the windows. She took the last of her drugs, which was an overdose. She turned the gas on and laid down to die. And that very afternoon, they turned the gas out for lack of payment. Isn't that odd? That's God. The main thing I'm trying to tell you is get out of the way. If you have an alcoholic husband or a wife who's still drinking, get out of the way. Here was Anne, here was me, and there was God. And when I got over here and put those two together, man, I'll tell you something really happened. Now, my husband goes into business with an alcoholic partner. You know, I sound like that soap opera as the stomach turns, don't I? When I tell this story, it just keeps going on and on. And I begged him not to, but he said, no, everybody that drinks too much you say is an alcoholic. But he went ahead and we sold our house. He took the savings, went into business, and 9 months later we're down the drain. Total bankruptcy. Business and personal bankruptcy. Now, we weren't young people. Worked a long time. Well, see, I had you people. And my sponsor told me I could only wear one dress at a time, eat one meal at a time, and sleep in one bed at a time. And that it was all right, that it would work out. And I believed her, and I knew it was true. But unfortunately, my husband didn't have a program. He did have Al-Anon at one time, but quit going. And he just sat comatose staring at a wall for about 2 weeks. And I finally motivated him back to work. Well, he picked up a disease that's worse than ours, and it's called compulsive working and compulsive sleeping. If anybody knows what that is, God have mercy on the people who have it. Because they're never forced too much to do anything about themselves. But this man ran like 17 devils were after him, working 15, 16 hours a day, coming home and eating and falling asleep on the couch, not undressing and going to bed most nights, too tired to take a shower. I stayed for 6 years watching this go on. I loved him too long to hate him. I had to walk away. Now, most everything has come around. When I started to walk away from him, I finally realized I couldn't take care of my grandson. He's now 15 years old. So I gave him back to my daughter, and she was well enough to accept him at this time. But less than 6 months after she took him, he became a full-blown addict alcoholic. So now we've got three of us in the program. He only lasted about 6 months out there, and he joined the program. And he's now been sober about 7 years, so we have three generations. My youngest grandson, he'll be 21 years old very soon. He started fooling around with drugs. All of a sudden, he split and left and went to Hawaii. I didn't worry about this one. I'd learned my lesson. And so I said, all right, Lord, I surrender him to you. I ask you, don't take your hand off his shoulder, and please send him a messenger. And I prayed this for about 5 or 6 months. One day I was having lunch with my daughter. She said, gee, I heard from Jeff. And I said, how's he doing? She said, well, he's working over there in some kind of a construction gang. And he has a boss that's a real religious nut. Said he talks about the Bible and Moses and all this stuff. And she said to her son, doesn't that bore you? And he said, no, the guy really knows what he's talking about. And my daughter said, the guy has the strangest name. His name is Jim Messenger. Well, it was just like God saying, I'm hearing you, kid. I'm in there working. And last Christmas, my grandson all of a sudden came home. And he's clean and he's sober. He's not going to a program, but he's doing fine. I don't care how he got that way. This way he stays that way. But everything goes around, comes around. Now, one thing more. I worked in pharmacy for many years. I was making enough money to support myself, but certainly not enough money to save. And I thought to myself one day, my God, when I'm 65 years old, they can retire me, and I can't live on Social Security. And I'm tired of working and waiting on people where 9 out of every 10 prescriptions will go across the counter for Valium or Librium. You know, you can't help these people. And I'd worked off and on in the cosmetic department. So I started asking my higher power, I said, Lord, is there any way at all that you can help me get out of this business and into something else? I'm totally trained in pharmacy. I can do everything with a prescription but dispense it. But I don't have any other training. But I do have a natural talent for helping people. And I don't brag about this. I'm just saying this is a God-given talent. And I would love to be able to do it, you know, and get paid for it. But how can I do it? Gosh, when I was first early sober, I went to work in pharmacy and I was in my late 20s, and the pharmacist said, you ought to go back to school and be a pharmacist. You have a natural talent. And I said, I can't. I'm too old. So in my 50s, I go back to school. And this goes to show you how it didn't change. But anyway, I went to Hawaii 1 year, and I'm laying there on the beach at an AA convention and saying, Father, either take the thought away from me or find some way for me to do something or make me content in pharmacy, but take this turmoil away. It was just... For a couple of years, this turmoil was going around, so because I didn't know what to do, I could surrender. And I gave it to him, and I forgot about it. I got home, one of my babies called me, and she said, Dottie, they're giving a course at UCLA. You really ought to go over there and see about it. And I said, well, that's fine, but I don't have the money for the tuition. And she said, well, I do, and let me give it to you. And I said, I can't do that. She said, you'd do it for me, wouldn't you? And I said, sure. She said, then let me do it, and you can pay me back. And I'm thinking, maybe that's what he wants me to do. So I went over there. And by this time, I had about 18, 19 years experience, practical experience, in sobriety and AA. They filled in the rest of the courses, and I worked for 40 hours a week and went to school for 3 years at night. That is, without a doubt, the hardest thing I've ever done. And I'd get willing, ready to quit. Every week I quit. I went back on Monday. My husband took the good car. I had some old furniture, and he got me a car that was an ex-fire chief's car and had a great big hole up underneath the thing where all the guts were, you know. So I would go to UCLA with boots and a blanket on my leg, hang my head out of the side because I had no defroster, no heater, no radio. And I went on four wheels in a prayer to UCLA, saying to God, you know, Lord, you and I are going to have a new car one day, aren't we? And you know, we have a new car. And so I walked out of there with my certificate. And for the past 6.5 years, I've been a private therapist in private practice, doing the thing I love to do the most. Oh, I thank God for that. I will never have any need that God won't fill. I have some wants that aren't filled, but I have more than I need. The most important thing is that I have sobriety, I have my daddy God, and I have all you people. It can't get richer than that. You know, I was reading the Bible the other day, and I read a story about a man named Jeremiah, and he was what was called the weeping prophet. And all he would do is go with the Lord and say, "Why, Lord, why?" And I thought, oh, he's an alcoholic, you know. So he was asking the Lord about, you know, why? And the Lord said, go down the hill here to the potter's shack and learn a lesson. So he goes down to the potter's shack. And the potter's got this beautiful bowl, and he's moving his foot up and down, and this wheel is spinning, and he's making this bowl. And all of a sudden he stops, and he takes the bowl off the wheel, and he breaks it up. And he kneads it like bread, you know. And Jeremiah said, what are you doing? He said, well, it had a flaw in it. I have to break it. I have to knead it. I have to make it pliable. I have to wait till it's real pliable in my hands. Because I have to make a vessel fit for the master's use. And I thought, oh, that's Dottie Shore. He had to break me. I had so many flaws. I had pathological lying, ego, criticism, stealing, rumor passing, you name it. I had so many flaws in me that the potter took me off the wheel and he broke me. And he kneaded me and he made me pliable. And then he put me back on his wheel again and then he started spinning. And he made this vessel fit for the master's use. And I looked at myself and I thought, am I fit for the master's use? Oh, God, I hope so. Thank you.